This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, if I was writing an apocalyptic novel about, for example, let's say China decides that they're going to essentially declare cyber war on the United States, and the United States doesn't quite know how or when to respond. When do you hit the threshold that this is actually war? If I was writing this novel, I would start it out with, let's take out a major airline, right? Just shut down the entire airline. Hundreds of thousands of people stranded all over the world because the airline's down. And then a half hour, 40 minutes later, take down the major stock exchange in the United States. Take down the New York Stock Exchange. And then, 20, 30 minutes later, take down one of the biggest newspapers in the United States. In fact, one of the biggest newspapers in the world. Let's take down the Wall Street Journal. Well, in the last hour and a half, all three have been taken down. So nobody knows why, as at the moment. And the official response is that the United crash an hour ago and the New York Stock Exchange crash 20, 30 minutes ago. And I'm talking computer crash, not, although the Dow was down 250 points, are unrelated to each other. And maybe the Wall Street Journal's page is back. I just heard that on MSNBC. I haven't verified it. Actually, it would be easy enough to go to WSJ.com and see what happens. I'll try that right now while we're talking. And, okay. The Wall Street Journal's page is back up. So much for that theory, right? Anyhow, it's fascinating. It's like both apparently, from early reports, from what we're hearing, both the United crash and the New York Stock Exchange crash were caused by the inability of their local servers to communicate with other servers. Now, there's this network called the Backbone Network, across the United States that traffic flows through. We don't know if this has to do with that. This could be one of the giant companies now that handle all that traffic. It could be anything. Could just be, one of those classic examples of, stuff happens. Mercury's not retrograde, so we can't blame that. But I think it's fascinating. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And what it points out, and by the way, at the same time that this is all happening, and I using China as the example, I was thinking about China because their stock market has been in free fall for 2 days. And they're quite freaked out about it. They're trying to stop stock sales. They're trying to stop people from selling stock. And China being, the People's Communist Republic of China or whatever the official name is, it's communist China. They have basically state-regulated and, in many cases, state-run or state-owned capitalism. And so the state regulators can come in and say pretty much anything they want. And in order to stop the market from falling any farther, so far the Chinese stock market, I believe, has fallen about 30%. Ours, as I recall, in 2008, fell a little more than 50%, didn't it? It was hitting 13,000 and it went down to the 6,000s. Maybe it was 50%, something in the neighborhood of 50%. So this Josh Noble reporting in Hong Kong, Gabriel Wildow in Shanghai in the Financial Times, interesting piece. It was just updated at 3:30 p.m. I guess that's Hong Kong time or Shanghai time. But in any case, or maybe that's British time. This is the Financial Times I'm sharing with you. Chinese authorities took drastic action to try to prop up sinking stocks on Wednesday. Today, banning listed company shareholders with big stakes from selling shares and using central bank money to bolster the market. Let me explain what that means. What they're saying is if you are the CEO of one of these companies, or if you're a senior executive or a founder of one of these companies that are listed on the Chinese stock market, you may not sell your shares. In other words, you can't bail out while the market's still intact. And they're hoping that that will stop the contagion, because what's happening is in China, you know, while in the United States, average working people only own a relatively small percentage of our stock. I don't have the percentage in front of me, and it's been a while since we've done a show on it, but my recollection is it's something well under 20%. Most stocks in the United States are held by either institutional investors, you know, like pension funds or, you know, the mutual funds, banks, things like that, or they're held by there's a variety of people who can hold stock, the small percentages hold by people held by or they're held by wealthy individuals. Okay, wealthy individuals and institutional investors account for the vast majority of the stock market in the United States. In China, though, they have been having a replay of 1929. I remember, and I realize this is probably an apocryphal story, and I've heard it from other places as well, and Gloria might have gotten it wrong, but Louise, what was Gloria's last? Gloria Swanson. I remember back in the 1970s, in 78, Louise and I started a community for abused kids up in New Hampshire, a vegetarian community. And we were looking around for famous vegetarians to get on our board of directors, and we ended up with Dick Gregory and Dennis Weaver. And I got to know Dennis really well and his wife, Jerry, who is just a wonderful person. Dennis passed away a year or two ago. I wrote the introduction to Dennis's autobiography, All the World's a Stage, which is just a brilliant book, reading about his life growing up, you know, from going from the southern United States and the Dust Bowl all the way up to, as I recall, Oregon or Washington State to pick strawberries. I mean, they were literally migrant pickers. And ultimately to Hollywood, you know. But anyway, and Gloria Swanson was one of them. And Gloria, every 6 months or so, we were living in New Hampshire. I'd take the train down to New York, and Gloria Swanson and I would have dinner in her apartment on Fifth Avenue overlooking Central Park in New York. And, you know, a good vegetarian dinner. we would cook it ourselves together. And she used to tell me these wild stories about Joe Kennedy. She hated Joe Kennedy. He, in her opinion, robbed her. Franklin Roosevelt made him the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. She was his mistress for a while also. But FDR made him the head of the SEC when he invented the SEC, saying it takes a crook to catch the crooks. And she said that Joe told her, you know, when a shoe sign boy offers me stock tip advice, I know it's time to get out of the market. In other words, when the average working person starts investing in the stock market, it's time to run, because they will flee the market at the slightest, you know, they're the jittery investors. Well, in China, this is what's been happening. Just like in the United States in the 1920s, there have been no limits on margin trading. In other words, people are borrowing money and taking their life savings as well and putting it into the Chinese stock market, because it's just been going up, 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 up for a decade and really rapidly. And so these people are getting really, really badly hurt. So what the Chinese government is saying to the big boys, to the large investors, they banned listed company shareholders with stakes of 5% or more from selling any shares for 6 months. And the ban also applies to senior company executives and board members, regardless of the size of their stakes. And the regulator said it would deal sternly with violators. Now, keep in mind, this is China. They have executed banksters. I mean, they take this stuff really seriously. So anyway, they've lost $2.6 trillion worth of equity so far in China.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But if I was writing that novel, that apocalyptic novel, I'm not sure I would make China the bad guy. I mean, you know, it could be ISIL. It could be anybody. You know, what I forgot to do was I forgot to turn on my call screening software. So I just booted it up, but sometimes it takes a minute or two to come alive. So I'm sitting here waiting because my computer's running insanely slow. So in the meantime, Let me share with you a story from Tom Tolles in today's Washington Post that I thought was really interesting and thoughtful. He says, he's quoting Carter Eskew, who is writing in the New York Times about Bernie Sanders. And, oh, that's interesting. I got the software up, and we have no Free Speech TV calls anyway. So, okay, cool. So Carter Eskew has gone from being an annoyance to a threat. We are live on Free Speech TV right now, right? Okay, cool. Bernie Sanders, from the point of view of the Hillary campaign, has gone from being an annoyance to a threat. Well, that's interesting, but what Tom Tolles says is this would put it right up there with National Lampoon's famous headline, pornography, threat or menace? You know, is it a threat or is it a menace? Not is it a threat or is it no big deal? Oh, suddenly my board just came up with all the calls on it. Eureka. Maybe we're having internet problems, too. Maybe the entire country is having internet problems. Daniel, in Arcadia, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Daniel, can you hear me?
Hi, Tom. Paul, I'd like to tell you, my mom told me to do something today, and I said, yeah, I would. But I'm going to practice my religion and watch Tom and be more informed.
Okay, thank you. What's up?
And so what I wanted to get to is Paul Krugman and Robert Reich have been warning us about this for years, how China knows our encryption backdoors, you know, to all our computers.
Right.
And this is just like, I mean, this is setting up, I don't know what they're trying to do with Russia, India, and China forming a World Trade Organization, their own IMF bank, which I'm totally against. As if our big banks ain't grotesque enough and our court ain't stupid enough. Now we got an international court that's going to overthrow this Machiavellian court.
Yeah.
It's just vanity.
Yeah. Who knows? You've touched on a couple of topics here. But, yeah, there and beyond that, virtually all the electronics sold in the United States now are made in China. And do we know that there are no backdoors built into the programmable memories that these things are shipped with, for example? There has been some concern in the past about that. Do we know? I mean, I don't think we do. I think we're far more vulnerable than the average American realizes. And I think this is the kind of stuff that keeps the White House and the NSA up awake at night and with good reason. I suspect if the next war is fought, it's not going to be fought with missiles. It's going to be fought on the Internet. And what they're going to do is they're going to shut down cities. They're going to shut down power grids. They're going to shut down septic systems. They're just going to bring everything, because it's all online. And most of it's online with virtually no security, Daniel. So, yeah, do you feel concerned? Yeah. Daniel, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Okay. Well, the hot news right now is, that United Airlines got shut down about an hour ago. My software's down? Oh, is that hysterical? Okay, I'm quitting out of the program here on my end. I'm wondering if the whole country is having computer problems right now. And if so, well, why? This is totally strange stuff. So anyway, let me get back to I've got a whole long list of stories here that I wanted to share with you today. As I was saying about China, here's the problem that China has. They're able to control the Chinese stock exchange, which operates out of Shanghai. There, it's called the Shenzhen Index. The Shanghai Composite is the name, just like the New York Stock Exchange, is the Dow, basically. And that exchange has lost $2.6 trillion in the last couple of days, and about half of all the companies, 1,476 stocks, have suspended trading because they They just don't want to get caught in the middle of it. And, okay, our call screen software is back up here. Boy, this is one of those, if anything can go wrong, it will days, right? So feel free to call in. We're taking calls right now. But anyhow, the cell, but Hong Kong is not where the Chinese trade stocks, it's where the global investors trade stocks, Chinese stocks. Hong Kong still has a sort of special status. And so they're not quite, that's called the Hang Seng Index, which is the Hong Kong stock exchange. And it has the Hang Seng Index, again from the piece in the Financial Times, suffered one of its biggest point drops on record, shedding 5.8% to erase all its gains over the previous year. So what are they doing? Well, the People's Bank of China said that they're helping state-owned China Securities Finance Corporation access liquidity to help the fund hold the line against the outbreak of systemic or regional financial risk. In other words, they're throwing money into the system. The Chinese, it's not quite a central bank. It's the Securities Finance Corporation. It's this, they kind of underpin the stock market. They're also buying shares directly using People's Bank of China. This is their central bank, using money from the People's Bank of China. And this is something that our Fed never did, going into the stock market and just buying huge amounts of stock. You know, well, we'll buy $1 trillion worth of stock. What does that do? It reinflates the stock market. You increase demand, the prices go back up. They're also giving $41 billion in a line of credit to brokerages. So this would be as if the Fed had given money to, well, we did give money to our big banks. Whether they used it to buy stocks or not is a whole different thing. But anyhow, they're talking about this mood of panic on the Chinese stock exchange. Not good. You know, in Europe, they're talking about contagion with regard to the Greek thing. And you know, is this... Anyway, there's a whole bunch of other things going on that I want to get into. One is, you know, one of the big issues, and I think, frankly, it is going to be the big issue of this election cycle. I may be proven wrong on this, but I would be surprised, is our insane trade policies. The fact that we have an $11 trillion trade debt. The fact that after we signed the South Korea trade agreement, our trade deficit with South Korea went up 38%. That after we signed NAFTA, we lost millions of jobs, and our trade deficit went up. That every single trade agreement that we've signed has caused us to lose jobs. That it's become so obvious that Congress 2 weeks ago, when they passed Fast Track, said, you know, okay, we know that if we sign any more trade agreements, we're going to lose millions of more American jobs, and so we're going to throw $700 million into the pot to retrain workers who have lost their jobs as a result of these trade agreements. And the retraining is just a scam. I mean, this is something the Republicans push. Democrats do too, but you know, Democrats do it with good intentions. The Republicans push it because they know that most of this money is going to end up in the hands of for-profit colleges. You know, it's, hey, it's free government money. Hey, let's get it. And the retraining of the workers, it's a joke. It's a scam. So here we have Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico right now is bankrupt, or on the edge of it. And why? Right? You say, you know, what has happened to Puerto Rico? They've been steadily sliding since 2006. On the right, from the Scott Walker crowd, right? Who, by the way, is Richard Nixon reincarnated. I believe that Scott Walker is the most dangerous politician in America right now. But in any case, from the Scott Walker right, you're hearing that, well, it's because Puerto Rico uses the U.S. minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, which is about 80% of the average median income in Puerto Rico, whereas in the United States, it's only 22% of the average median income. So they're saying, see, it's, you know, it's the minimum wage that did it. Excuse me, it's 28% in the U.S. It's 77% of per capita income in Puerto Rico. This according to a piece over by Bryce Covert over at Think Progress. But it turns out what happened in 2006 that started the collapse of Puerto Rico was up until 2006, We had this law in the United States that said that if you move your company to Puerto Rico, you don't have to pay any federal income taxes. And so a whole bunch of pharmaceutical companies and a whole bunch of manufacturing companies left the United States and moved to Puerto Rico. This was back in the 80s. And now, in 2006, we did away with that. We said we're doing away with this tax exemption. And what has happened? Well, as the article says, one big factor that she pointed to is the termination of Section 936 in the tax code, which allowed businesses operating on the island to go tax-free. It not only enticed many to relocate, but when it was phased out in 2006, that had a domino effect that spread through the whole economy. Manufacturing jobs, hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Manufacturing jobs in Puerto Rico have dropped 34% since 2006. Surprise, surprise, Puerto Rico's losing their manufacturing sector. Back to drinking my sweets. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome back. Welcome back. Press take. Okay, Tom Hartman here with you. It's interesting. It's interesting. You know, a major airline goes down, then the stock market goes down. If the next thing that goes down is the water supply of New York City or the electricity for Chicago, or if Los Angeles goes brown, then I'll start to be concerned. Right now, it just looks like a coincidence. But back to my point about Puerto Rico, and then I will pick up your calls. Thank you, Troy. Breaking news. This is from the Belfast Telegraph. Down in Chile, you know, the country that Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan totally ruined back in the day with Pinochet, the dictator who murdered thousands of his own people. And then, you know, in order to facilitate the imposition of austerity, right-wing, trickle-down Reaganomics, economics in Chile, privatizing their social security system, cutting their welfare programs, all that kind of thing. Chile has recovered from that, and I think, is Michelle Bachelet still the president or prime minister down there? I'm not sure, but in any case, it looks like they are set to decriminalize cannabis. Their Senate, or the lower house of Congress, their House of Representatives, their equivalent of the House, just voted 68-39 to make it legal for people to grow their own pot, up to six plants, and to possess up to 10 grams in addition to your six plants. So, hey, it's traveling all around the world. But back to Puerto Rico, the point that I was making about the Puerto Rican crisis, and the reason why I think this is going to be a huge issue in the upcoming election, and it concerns/disappoints me that I have not heard anything about this from any of the Democratic candidates running for president except for Senator Sanders. And, of course, you will not hear one word about this from any of the Republican candidates. Is that our trade policies are killing us. We now have before Reagan came into office, before we started with these crazy so-called free trade deals, they're not free trade. You pass a piece of legislation that's thousands of pages long with all kinds of rules. That's not free trade. That's heavily managed trade. The question is, who's it managed for the benefit of? Is it managed for the benefit of the average American worker? Or is it managed for the benefit of transnational corporations that may be based in the United States, but don't frankly give a rat's ass about the United States? They only care about profits. And I think it's fairly clear that these so-called free trade deals, whether it's permanent normal trade relations with China or whether it's NAFTA or whether it's CAFTA or whether it's SHAFTA, whatever it may be, this is not free trade. This is managed trade to the benefit of somebody, and it's not you, me, or the average worker. It's not people like my dad who worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, back when we still had tool and die shops in the United States. I realize there's still a few out there, but most of them have gone overseas. Why? Because we changed our trade policies. So Puerto Rico's trade policy, see, corporations, this is not about evil corporations. Corporations are not intrinsically evil. They are set up along sociopathic lines, but there are ways that you control sociopaths, especially non-human sociopaths, like a corporation. And that is by setting rules for the game that require them not to behave like sociopaths. So you say, yeah, you know, you're supposed to make money, but you can't do it killing people. You can't make money, for example, to the fossil fuel industry and the Koch brothers, you can't make money anymore by destroying our planet and the future of the human race. You know, it's just, you know, we're going to change the rules of the game by imposing a carbon tax so that, you know, gradually your industry is going to phase out and it's going to be replaced by solar and wind. And yeah, you're not going to like that. And yeah, the Supreme Court says you can buy a bunch of politicians like Jim Inhofe who can squeal about, oh, it's all a myth and those scientists are all, you know, just making this stuff up. But in any case, the point is, this is not about sociopathic corporations, my rant here. My rant is that corporations will go wherever the profit is. They just follow the money. And the rules of the game of business are defined by governments. And so if our government says, hey, if you move your factory to Puerto Rico, you don't have to pay any federal income taxes, hundreds of companies move their factories to Puerto Rico. In 2006, when you say, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, factories started leaving Puerto Rico. Now, they weren't coming back to the United States because they went to Puerto Rico in the first place to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Instead, what they're doing is they're going to China, they're going to Vietnam, because our trade policies allow this. Prior to 1980, our trade policies did not allow this kind of behavior on the part of corporations. If they moved overseas and brought their goods back, they got hit with a tariff when they came back into the United States, and, you know, why bother? But now, you know, it's libertarianism on steroids, right? Open borders, no tariffs, no problem. So Puerto Rico has lost 34% of their manufacturing jobs. I don't know how many factories they've lost, but 34% of their manufacturing jobs just since 2006 when this tax law got changed. So this is how, just like one little tiny change, this is like, you know, one paragraph in the tax code that got changed in 2006, and it's taken down Puerto Rico. And what's the right-wing response in the United States to this? Oh, well, Puerto Rico's in debt. You know, throw them into bankruptcy. Or cut the minimum wage down there. It's $7.25 an hour. Take it down to $2 an hour. Those people in Puerto Rico make too much money as it is. This is crazy talk. It's absolute crazy talk. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Summer. I've been ranting for 40 minutes here. Time to let you chime in. Cynthia in Chicago. Hey, Cynthia, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the cyber attacks. I think they're more than a coincidence. I'm in the tech field, and I don't necessarily believe in too many coincidences.
Well, it may well be, Cynthia, that right now, you know, over at the White House, they're sitting around looking at a communication that just came from China or from ISIL or from God only knows. I mean, you know,
right.
the Lord's Liberation Army in Uganda. I mean, it could be anybody who's got a laptop and a high level of hacking expertise saying, you know, okay, we just took down your largest airline and we just took down your largest stock exchange. You know, the Department of Defense is next unless you do X. And of course, they're not going to call a press conference and say we're being blackmailed or we're being threatened.
But what I wanted to do is echo your sentiment in that we are much more vulnerable technically than we think. And the point that I wanted to make is that I worked at a company. Companies are focused on securing their networks internally from their employees.
Right.
In case the employees have to leave. We had a guy who left our company. Our CIO issued a challenge saying that, hey,
CIO, by the way, for people who don't know, is a chief information officer. That's the person who's responsible for your technology. Back to you, Cynthia.
Right.
Sorry.
And no worries. And he said, well, we'll pay you if anyone can break in our network. Well, the guy that built our network that left broke into the network, and we paid him. But then the CIO issued another challenge and sent out the email and said, don't let anyone from outside know, or no one from outside can know. Our biggest vulnerabilities are from outside for people who have left. And so this was years ago, but it's been many companies I've worked at have done similar things. They don't look outside, and so we're much more vulnerable. And the final thing is, I don't think trade will be a big issue in this election. And the reason I say that I don't think people are still aren't paying attention. If someone can echo over and over that TPP and Fast Track are NAFTA 2.0 and it's responsible for our jobs leaving, maybe it might break through some of the consciousness.
Well, Donald Trump is saying this, and Bernie Sanders is saying this. And I think that that's why Bernie Sanders is drawing crowds of 10,000 people and Donald Trump is polling at 10% in the Republican primaries.
Well, you got a point there. But I just feel like people aren't paying attention. And maybe as the election gets closer or as it gets time to vote, maybe they will.
I would not underestimate the American people's awareness of this. I mean, keep in mind, Ross Perot got almost 20% of the entire presidential vote. And that was in 1992. And that was just on the probability that we'd get screwed by these deals.
That's true. That is true.
You know, now we know in retrospect, you know, we have an $11 trillion trade debt that we never had before Reagan. And so we'll see. Cynthia, you may well be right. I mean, there's so little information about this, and the networks will not talk about this because they're owned by big corporations that are making money on international trade, too. Cynthia, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Right back with your calls here on Anything Goes Summer. And I got a huge stack of news to continue with for the next 2 hours. Stick around. And welcome back. Corky, watching Free Speech TV in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, you're driving me crazy with this free trade.
Really? Why is that?
Because what this is, it's not free trade. We are becoming distributors for products that we made. We just contracted China and Vietnam and all these low-wage countries to manufacture for us. Then we bring it over here and we sell it. Well, you know the big money is at the cash register, right?
Right.
It's not the guy who makes it. It's not the guy who just transports the products. It's the guy who sells it at the cash register.
Right.
And that's what we've become.
That's why the Waltons are the richest family in America, you know, by far.
Walton, distributors. That's who makes the money.
Yeah.
And we don't want to manufacture. That's below us. We get our hands dirty when we manufacture. Why not get these low-wage countries to get their hands dirty and pollute their environment, and we'll sit back here and make all the big money?
Well, that was the theory. That was essentially how this thing was being sold by Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush back in 1992, when it was just NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, was, you know, let's transfer from being a dirty economy where we make things, physical things, but we end up, you know, polluting the Cuyahoga River so it catches on fire or killing Lake Erie with our pollution. Let's let other countries deal with that, and we will move into the new era of information technology and software and internet and all these white collar jobs. We're going to make a fortune. Nobody's going to have to get their hands dirty. And it was a lie, Corky.
Yeah, well, you see, this is what they do to us. I mean, you can make a product, right? You know what the first piece of product that you make, what do they call it? A prototype.
Right.
Once you make the prototype, you got it all down. You got a machine that does this. You got a machine that does that. You need a guy to stand there and push the button, feed the product into the machine to make the products.
Right.
Once you got that all done, you can use an uneducated backwoods and a mud hut guy to push the button and feed the product.
Right.
And then you bring it back here. Why do you think everybody wants to come here to sell? Because so far we still make the most money in the world, although we're going downhill, as you can see by China's decline.
Yeah.
We don't have the money to buy that stuff, then China suffers.
Right. And not only that, I mean, you know, I think, yes, I agree with you, Corky. And I think China is suffering because, Greece, there is some contagion around Europe out of the Greek situation. And that is consumers are dialing back because they're nervous and they're dialing back. I'm in Europe every year. And over the last two decades, you see more and more and more Chinese goods everywhere you look now in Europe. And of course, the same thing in the United States, and we're in recession. And so China's economy has been cooling off, has been slowing down. And, you know, and that's whacking their stock market.
Yeah, because the people want more money now. They did the same thing in South Korea when they built, when they made sneakers.
Yeah.
People got smart and we want more money.
Excellent point. Corky, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Wow, lots going on here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think what's up is the world economy is getting ready to kick the bucket.
Yeah, the crash of 2016 is on its way.
Yeah, everything we're looking at is just a symptom. The Chinese market's starting to collapse. Well, the European markets were collapsing before 1929 happened in America. Generally, that's the way things work. The weaker markets go before New York goes down.
Yeah.
It just may happen again.
I got the newsletter. You'll recall if you watch regularly or listen regularly, Ed, that we had Marianne and I'm forgetting her name, her sister's name. We had the Aiden sisters on this show. They do this newsletter called Aiden Forecast, the Aiden Forecast, and that Louise and I subscribed to, and we just got this month's edition. And in it, they just made a passing reference to the fact that, you know, a 2008-style stock market crash in the United States is now not out of the question. So back to you, Ed.
Of course. But now the other symptoms are the governments of the world starting to collapse, you know, like the weakest governments, Greece, Puerto Rico, next be Italy, then Spain, maybe France. Governments are going under.
Are the governments going under, or are the people revolting and saying enough of, you know, austerity and Reaganomics? And that's what has been inflicted on Europe is Reaganomics, Thatcheronomics, they call it there.
Well, the bankers have loaned them so much money that they're causing them to go under. They can't meet the interest payments.
Yeah. And this is the thing that, you know, nobody mentions. I was reading a piece in the Financial Times yesterday, and they were talking about, and there's actually a great analysis of this over at economyincrisis.org, I believe is the website, about how the world is awash in debt. We're you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt, both private and public, all around the world. And nobody points out that most all of that debt is issued by banksters, and those banksters are skimming off interest from that debt, right? So the entire world is operating on credit right now, which means that the banksters basically control every part of every economy in some small way, or they profit off every part of every economy. And that's no way to run a financial system.
But it's the way it works.
Exactly.
You leave the banksters alone, and they take over every time you leave them alone.
Yeah.
If you cut back on the rules and regulations, they go crazy, and they try to own the world.
Yeah, there you go. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Jay in Las Cruces, New Mexico, you like the TPP?
Oh, Tom, I got on the air. Hey, I just wanted to say that I have to agree with the president on this, because I think that I would liken us to not having a free trade agreement, or to for there to be one and us not to be a part of it and not have a seat at the table, to sticking our fingers in our ears and saying, hey, I don't want any part of what goes on in the world. I think the president's playing a little bit of chess here, not checkers, and it's not that it's the ideal way to do business. That it's a realistic way. You know, when you buy a Toyota, there are parts that are manufactured here and parts that are manufactured overseas. It's the way it is nowadays.
Jay, I respect your trust in our president, but that said, you have no idea what's in the TPP, and neither do I. And you know, we just don't know what it's going to do. But what we do know is, A, this is not free trade. This is heavily managed trade. We're talking about a multi-thousand-page agreement. So it's heavily managed trade. This is corporate trade. This is not free trade, number one. And number two, every single time we have done one of these kind of so-called free trade agreements, and they've been sold to us as free trade, you know, it's just like, you know, George W. Bush sold deregulating air emissions as the Clean Air Act, right, or the Clear Skies Initiative. Let's let the smokestacks dump more, you know, crap into our air. It's being sold as free trade, but you don't know that.
Let me jump in one more time if I can before I kick off. The thing that's, I think the realistic thing, because since I live down here in New Mexico, real close to the border, is that the people out in the fields doing the work, or there's a certain type of people out in the fields that do the work now, and there's people who just can't do the work anymore. And that, you know, I'm talking about people who are maybe overly educated. Maybe I'm trying to get to the point that the white people just, they can't go out there anymore, and the people won't hire them because they're not accustomed to doing that type of work. Maybe Corky had a point that we don't want to do this type of work.
It's not that. It's that. You know, when John McCain said basically Americans will not pick strawberries out in the fields of Arizona for $50 an hour, his office was flooded with calls from Americans who were saying, yes, I would be glad to pick strawberries in the hot sun for $50 an hour. The fact of the matter is that the wages that are being paid are so low that, you know, for much of this kind of work, that only people who are desperate, and they're desperate by virtue of the fact that they're not U.S. citizens, and they're desperate to stay here and hoping that someday they can become U.S. citizens, will say, okay, I'll do it for that wage. And that's no way to run an economy. Richard, in driving through Illinois, Richard, got a minute left in this hour. It's yours.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? I'm not sure a minute's going to cover what I was trying to do, because I wanted to make a comment and then get your opinion on something. Basically, I'm kind of getting the impression with this free trade stuff, they're doing to us what they did with, like, Homeland Security and all this other stuff. They're using fear of not being a part of, like, the world economy and not controlling trade to force us into something that's going to cut our throats anyway.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And that's basically been their sales pitch. You know, if we don't get into this TPP with Vietnam and Malaysia, where it's legal, actually, to have slave labor, if we don't get into this thing, it's going to, you know, they're going to do it anyway without us, and we're going to get screwed. Let them do it. You know, I think we need to go back to trade policies that are American trade policies that benefit American, real American companies and real American workers. And I think that Mexico should do the same thing. I mean, Mexico has been wiped out by NAFTA. Early on, they did great. You know, all these American manufacturers moved to Mexico. But then as soon as China started saying, oh, you know, we'll take it, they moved offshore. Now Mexico's in trouble. Richard, thank you for the call. I totally agree.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's really important that you understand what happened in Puerto Rico. I realize this is not something that is on the tips of the tongues of everybody you're talking to. But it should be. Because what it illustrates, Puerto Rico is going bankrupt. There are people who say, you know, America's going bankrupt, right? This is the big Republican talking point. We're $16, $17 trillion in debt. We're going bankrupt. And we've got an $11 trillion trade debt. We're going bankrupt. Why? The same reason Puerto Rico is going bankrupt. Now, Puerto Rico doesn't control their own currency. They use the U.S. dollar. So they're, you know, they don't have the ability to devalue their currency and get out of their bankruptcy. I mean, they don't have sovereignty. But the United States does. But still, in both cases, our problems and their problems go back to the exact same source, which is the loss of manufacturing. Back in 1776, Adam Smith published a book, same year that Thomas Jefferson wrote and signed the Declaration of Independence, with a little help from his friends, you know, John Adams and John Jay and Ben Franklin. 1776, it was called Wealth of Nations. And Adam Smith pointed out in that book, which is still in print and you're welcome to read, although actually he wrote another book, I believe it was a couple years later, it might have been a couple years before, called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was a warning about unregulated capitalism. It was a warning about how if we let those with money define all the rules of a marketplace, that the marketplace will lack morality and will become actually harmful. In A Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith warned about the invisible hand of the marketplace. And frankly, in Wealth of Nations, his 1776 book, Adam Smith warned about the phrase "the invisible hand" only appears once, even though the Reaganites have turned it into a religion. And I'll explain exactly what that religion is in just a second. But in that book, he talked about how a country only becomes wealthy when they make things. That is the wealth of a nation. I think Japan is a great example of this. Here's Japan. I've been to Japan many, many times. It is a modern industrial. Their trains are, they got a super 200-mile-an-hour train, 300-mile-an-hour train. Great infrastructure, lots of manufacturing, good life. I mean, people say, well, the economy's been stagnant. Yeah, it's been stagnant, but everybody has health insurance. Everybody has old age pensions. People are not homeless. They're not having a crisis. It's just basically stable. And what Adam Smith said is that it's manufacturing. And the reason I mentioned Japan is because Japan has virtually no natural resources. Right? You could argue that what made the United States as rich as we are was the fact that when Europeans first stole this continent from the Native Americans and murdered them in one of the largest genocides in the history of the world, that there was all this natural wealth on the North American continent that the Native Americans had intentionally not exploited. There was forests, there were buffalo, there were flocks of pigeons, which are now extinct, the carrier pigeons. There were minerals, there was gold, there was iron ore, there was coal, you name it, it was here. And Europeans came over to this continent, killed off the Native Americans, and then, for the next 150 years or so, basically just, we got rich by taking raw materials and turning them into manufactured goods. We dug up iron ore out of the ground and we turned it into steel. And Andrew Carnegie built a fortune and an empire, and we built railroads that went from continent to continent, and it was all made in the USA, for example. And in Japan, what they have done is, with the power of intellect, they have, as I said, virtually no natural resources. They don't have the huge forests that we have for raw material for building. They don't have much mining. They don't have, it's a rocky island out in the middle of the Pacific, not in the middle, but, off the coast of Asia in the Pacific. But what they do have is brain power, and using that brain power, they said, we are going to build a manufacturing empire here by importing raw materials and exporting finished goods. We're going to make things. And that was what Adam Smith talked about. He said that the wealth of a nation is increased when that nation makes things. And it's decreased. The wealth of a nation is decreased when that nation not only doesn't make things, but must buy things from other nations in order to have things. Prior to the Reagan administration, we were the world's largest manufacturer of finished goods. We made refrigerators, we made televisions, we made cars, we made, you name it, we made it. We made socks and shoes and Levi jeans. Levi moved their last factory out of the United States, six, 8 years ago. I was doing this show when it happened, the day that the news broke. I remember talking about this very topic on the air. The example that Adam Smith used in Wealth of Nations was a stick, a tree limb laying on the ground. So this is not considered the wealth of the nation, right? This doesn't enhance the wealth of the nation. But if you apply human intellect and labor to it, by carving that stick into an axe handle, it now represents something that has value, and it's value that will probably last for 100 years. It's multi-generational value. So the wealth of the nation has just, say that axe handle is worth $5. and you do it in the United States, America just became $5 richer. Even if we sell that axe handle to China, they're going to have to pay us $5. We just got $5 richer. Manufacturing builds the wealth of nations. And the whole idea of Reaganomics and so-called free trade was to say, we don't need manufacturing anymore. It's another one of these bizarre religions. This whole Reaganomics religion that somehow the marketplace, the billionaires and the transnational corporations, they know what's best. The marketplace makes a trillion decisions a second. It's far smarter than the citizens or their elected representatives. So we need to just turn everything over to the marketplace. This is Milton Friedman. This is von Mises. This is Hayek. This is the religion that has been driving the EU. This is the religion that is driving the United States. This is the religion, and it's wrong. It's a religion because it's a belief based in, you know, without evidence. And China figured this out 25, 30 years ago and said, hey, we're going to do what the United States did for 150 years. And by the way, this wasn't an original idea to us. Alexander Hamilton stole this idea from the British. And the British, back in the 1500s, stole it from the Dutch. So, to bring this back to Puerto Rico, you need to tell your friends. Puerto Rico has lost 34% of their manufacturing jobs just since 2006, and that's why they're going bankrupt. America, the United States, our continental America, has lost 60,000 factories just since George W. Bush was installed by the Supreme Court as President of the United States in 2001. 60,000 factories. Every one of those factories that made things that added to the wealth of our country. And ever since then, actually ever since the Reagan era, when Reagan came into office, we were the number one manufacturer of finished goods, the number one creditor to the world. When Reagan left office, we were the number one importer of, well, by the time Bush left office, we were the number one importer of finished goods and the number one debtor in the world. And it's gotten worse ever since.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's called free trade, stupid. And we need to bring manufacturing back to the United States. And Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are talking about it only. And welcome back. Sherry, watching Free Speech TV in Denver. Hey, Sherry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Oh, good. I've listened to you for years, and if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't have known about Bernie Sanders. Because I would listen to you when I was traveling, and we got the radio stations, and they're all gone now.
Yeah, I know.
Completely. I mean, all the stations that I listen to, so the only way I can listen to you now is on the TV, which I tape.
Right.
Okay. The reason I'm calling is I saw Bernie at the rally at Denver, and there were 5,000 people. You know, it wasn't a made-up number.
Right.
And it was wonderful. And he hasn't changed anything. Everything he has said for years, he has said repeatedly.
Nothing, he's been saying this stuff since the late 70s.
That's right. I mean, and I've heard you say that, too, you know, when I started listening. And I thought, this isn't a man or a politician that has to get up there and go with what they think people want to hear.
Right.
It's not made up. And the thing that's bothering me and the reason I called, and I've heard it, actually I heard it yesterday on another program, and I heard it this morning on national news, and it was that Bernie would not win. And that the Democratic Party or the powers that are backing Hillary are not backing him. And right. Everything that does come out and the story, and I read the New York Times, are negative.
Yeah.
It's as if the people don't have any intelligence and they're the ones that are going to tell us who we should vote for and who is going to win. And I've spoken to people that are independents, that are liberals, and I've heard the same thing repeated to me.
Mm-hmm. This is,
so I know who they're listening to, and I know what they're reading.
Yeah, this is the mainstream narrative, and I keep saying this, Sherry. It's really I think there's a lot of truth into it. The mainstream media is the insiders, right? These pundits that you see on television all the time who get, you know, paid a couple thousand dollars every time they appear on TV. They are the insiders. They suck up to the power structure. They're part of the power structure. They are the sycophants and the enablers for the power structure in the United States. And they're not going to sacrifice that. They're not going to threaten that by challenging, you know, by siding with somebody who's an outsider. Bernie is an outsider right now. The other declared Democratic candidates are all insiders right now. That said, if you go back to 1972, there was a wave in America of people who were not upset about the fact that our middle class was being eviscerated, because this was before Reagan, and we had a strong middle class in 1972. There was a wave of people who were upset about the Vietnam War. And an outsider, although you could argue George McGovern was an insider because he was a member of the Senate and all that sort of thing, but the Democratic Party did not want George McGovern. They wanted Ed Muskie. Nixon took out Ed Muskie. The story is, and I'm not sure it's ever been confirmed, but you know that Chuck Colson or one of his buddies went to Maine and put LSD in his coffee because Ed Muskie got up on this flatbed truck and started blithering. But when that anti-war outsider wave elevated McGovern onto the ticket, the Democratic Party then closed ranks and got behind him. I think if Bernie can make it through the primaries, the Democratic Party will actually get behind him. So, you know, it's just, we have to persevere. Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A federal court, this is fascinating stuff. This has appeared in a number of different places. The one I'm reading is from TPM Cafe by Bill Clark. Yesterday, U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, the U.S. Court of Appeals. This would be the Court of Appeals for the U.S. for the D.C. District. This is the court that is just below the Supreme Court. In fact, most often when federal court justices are picked to become Supreme Court justices, they are picked from the D.C. Circuit Court. And they voted 11-0. And the majority of the appointees on this court, the D.C. Circuit, are Republican appointees. They voted 11-0 to uphold a ban on federal contributions by individuals who contract with the government, to say that, yes, that is constitutional. We can say to an individual who has a contract with the federal government, if you're taking money from our government, you may not lobby the government and you may not involve yourself in politics. This is amazing. I mean, this is, as Joe Biden would say, this is a BFD. And by the way, 85% of American people, according to a poll from the New York Times, quoted by Bill Clark over at TPM Opinion, TPM Cafe. According to a poll from the New York Times, some 85% of the American people believe that the way political campaigns are funded either needs fundamental changes or a complete rebuild. 46% of Americans say a complete rebuild. 39% say fundamental changes. I think those are the same thing. It adds up to 85% of Americans. Get money the hell out of politics. Now, with this federal court decision, and I'm predicting this, none of this is going to happen. But with this federal court decision, here are the things that the Obama administration, if President Obama wanted to clean up money in politics tomorrow morning, which would work mostly to the benefit of, frankly, Bernie Sanders. It would work to the benefit of the candidates who are not sponsored by billionaires. And it would work most against people like Scott Walker, who's only a viable politician right now because of money from the Koch brothers and a few other billionaires. It would work against Scott Walker. It would work against Hillary Clinton. It would work to the benefit of Bernie Sanders and I have no idea what it would do to Donald Trump, but here are the things that could be done. Number one, and this is a list that Bill Clark put together, but you know I've talked about all of these things at various times. Number one, the president could issue an executive order to require federal contractors to disclose all political contributions they make and to bar contractors from bidding on federal contracts for 2 years if they spend too much money to influence a federal race or a member of Congress. And that was ruled constitutional yesterday by the U.S. Federal Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. One step below the Supreme Court. 11-0. It's kind of a slap in the face to Citizens United. Okay, so number one, the president could issue this executive order. And I guarantee you, Koch Industries has federal contracts, among others. Number two, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Remember a week or three ago, I was saying, please call Mary Jo White over at the SEC. I had called her office and left a message for her, and I encouraged you to, and I know a number of you did. And I'm guessing they were quite upset with me. Mary Jo White is the commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and she has the authority to literally, I mean, this is Public Citizen has been pushing this thing for months. They had posters in Union Station for about a month. Mary Jo White could say, she could create a rule saying any publicly traded company that spends any money at all on politics has to do two things. Number one, they have to disclose that expenditure. So if a publicly traded company, if GE wants to, or any publicly traded company, if they want to spend money to buy politicians, they have to publicly disclose it, number one. And number two, they have to ask their shareholders if it's okay. That could be done tomorrow. Number three, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, because we own our airwaves, we lease them to the radio TV stations, and in the cable sphere, it's a little, it's not quite as clear, but cable rights of way run through public places and under public roads and things. So arguably, this is part of our commons, too. And that's always been the argument. That's why cable companies have to pay a fee to support C-SPAN, which is the price of being on cable television. The FCC could issue a rule saying that broadcasters have to provide reasonable time for all House, Senate, and presidential candidates for free. So there's no need for political ads. And number four, the IRS could say to groups like all these front groups that the Koch brothers have set up, Karl Rove's front groups, the front groups on the Democratic side as well, all these PACs and things, they're all set up as nonprofits. Nonprofits, according to IRS law, have to have as their principal purpose doing good works, basically, right? Educating and supporting people, helping people. Now, they claim that they're doing that by informing people, but we all know that that's a front. The IRS could simply say, sorry, political advocacy is not a purpose for which a nonprofit can be organized, and just deny all of them nonprofit status. It wouldn't put them out of business, but it would make them far less, shall we say, profitable. By the way, did you see that California has stripped the nonprofit status of Blue Cross Blue Shield for hoarding $4 billion in cash? They said, you're acting just like a for-profit corporation. Damn it, we're going to make you one. It's amazing. Anyhow, these are the things that could be done. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University in Minnesota, came up with this stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And my apologies. I've been attributing that story to Bill Clark. He did the AP photo. David Schultz is the guy who wrote the article that's over at TPM. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And Kevin in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Kevin, you wanted to add to the Puerto Rico conversation?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that back around 2006, before the Democrats took over Congress, Congress passed a law that said that if a company moved its operations overseas, they could write that off their taxes.
Right.
So that feeds right into this problem with Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now they also got a tax break moving out of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I thought that had been the case since the 80s.
No, and the only one who was like complaining about it on TV was Lou Dobbs.
Well, that's interesting.
At the time.
Yeah, well, Lou is a bit of an economic nationalist. You know, just because he's a conservative doesn't mean he's always wrong. You know, broken clock is right twice a day. So, okay. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Kevin. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Florence in Rainier, Washington. Hey, Florence, what's up?
Oh, hi there. We're coming across people who don't know who Bernie is all over the place. Mm-hmm. And we need yard signs. So I was wondering if that friend of yours who offered $250,000 would like to buy 20,000 yard signs from the campaign, and then you could send them to all the volunteers in all the states.
I have a feeling that they're going to figure out a way to do something to support Bernie with that money. But that said, aren't there yard signs for sale over at BernieSanders.com?
They are, but they're quite expensive because they need to, you know, they're fundraising from them.
Right.
You can buy 25 and it's cheaper.
Right.
But it's still a lot for the volunteers to, you know, to buy.
Yeah.
To spend.
Yeah. I'm sorry I don't have a source for free ones right now, Florence, but and it's a shame. If the party was behind Bernie, they would be. And if he wins the primary, the party will be behind him and they will be free. But, you know, right now it's the primary and. And I don't think that Hillary's yard signs are free either, although I could be wrong. I honestly don't know, and I have no idea about the other, you know, candidates. So thanks a lot for the call, though. Great to hear from you. Derek in Mauston, Wisconsin. Hey, Derek, what's up?
Hi there. I actually have a question about the whole Bernie Sanders thing, too. I've never gotten involved in this type of thing where I want to be proactive here, and I want to get out there and try to get Bernie's name out there. I live in rural Wisconsin, and most of the people around here, they're Republican, and a lot of them are pushed into that by their factories, so they don't really know. They don't know much about politics, but I want to get out there and find a way to volunteer my time, but I don't know the best way to go about that. I tried searching all over the Sanders website, and I sent an email, and all I got back was this, you know, automated thing to donate money.
Right.
Well, I donated some money, but that's not, I need to do more than that.
Yeah. I can tell you what's going on, Derek.
Bernie's going to get pushed away.
Yeah.
He's going to have a hard time.
Well, I agree. What's happening right now with the Bernie campaign is that, and this is not like inside information that I've heard from anybody inside the campaign. This is just my own observation. So I may be wrong on this, but I don't think I am. I think that they expected to have a good reception. And I think that they expected that his message would resonate and that, you know, people would show up. But I don't think that they expected that they were going to be pulling 10,000 people when he shows up in town, you know. And in fact, most of the venues, like the venue that they booked in Maine, in Portland, Maine, they booked a venue for 300 people. It was just going to be a little town hall meeting. And 5,000 people showed up, you know. And so they had to move it to a stadium. And this has happened to, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 times now. And so what I believe I saw in a press release from the Sanders campaign, or maybe it was a news story about them, and this was a week or so ago, was that over the course of the month of July, because we're still, you know, we're a year and a half away from the election, I'm not sure how long it is until the Democratic primaries, but, you know, it's at least 6, 8, 10 months until the Democratic primaries, that sometime in the next couple of weeks, they are building that infrastructure out right now. They're building out the local groups. They're hiring staff because they have the money to do that. And they're going to be able, they will soon have the ability for you to go to their website and say, I'd like to volunteer. And they'll be able to say, great, here's, where are you? Here's what you can do. Here's, you know, here are the things that you can do. So for the moment, yeah, the as far as I know, the best thing that you can that they can do right now on their website is sell Bernie material and you know, sign up. If you sign up, you will almost certainly get, I would guess, again, I'm not a representative of the Sanders campaign, and you know, I will vote for Bernie in the primary, but as I said, if Hillary's the nominee, I'll work for her too. But all of that said, if you sign up at BernieSanders.com, just like if you sign up at HillaryClinton.com, when they're in a situation where they can make use of volunteers, which is going to be very soon, they'll let everybody know on their email list.
Okay.
So
right.
just hang out and, you know, let them know. And if there's a feedback on there, and I think that there is, where you can send them emails. You know, send them one saying, hey, I'd like to volunteer. I'd like to do more. And in the meantime,
I signed up.
The one thing that we can all do is just tell everybody we know, about not just Bernie, because Bernie is very clear. This is not about him, but it's about the positions that he is taking. And these are positions that, regardless of, I mean, he is just basically taking us back to the core of the Democratic Party. He's taking us back to FDR, to LBJ, to Harry Truman. He's taking us back to the core values, to Jack Kennedy. He's taking us back to the core values of the Democratic Party, which is, you know, building a strong middle class, an economy and a country that works for everybody, not just the billionaires. Whereas the Republican Party is exclusively the party of the billionaires. And in fact, they're aggressively trashing the middle class. Scott Walker now in Wisconsin, you know, he's doing like five different things to trash workers in Wisconsin.
Well, he's destroying us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. You're in Wisconsin. You know about this.
And, oh, God. Yeah. I tried to recall him. You know, the thing that shocks me the most is that the media tries to be, and even Bernie Sanders, he's so surprised at this. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not that old. You know, I'm in my 30s. So I've only been in politics for a short amount of time. But the people that I know, the people that were involved in Occupy Wall Street, the people that were involved in trying to get Walker out, we have been waiting for somebody like Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
you know, honest to God, we need this, and we know it, and we've been waiting for it. We are there for him. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Bill Clinton campaigned on a speech called the New Covenant speech. I reprinted it in my book Threshold: The Crisis of Western Civilization, and he campaigned as an FDR liberal. He governed as an Eisenhower Republican. Actually, he didn't even govern as an Eisenhower Republican. Eisenhower expanded labor unions, expanded welfare, expanded Social Security. He governed more like a Richard Nixon Republican, by and large. Barack Obama campaigned as an FDR liberal. You'll recall he campaigned, you know, he talked about single-payer health care would be the best way to go, but a public option might be a way to get us there. We didn't get that. I don't think that we can blame Barack Obama for everything with regard to his not governing as an FDR liberal, because he had a Congress that was just totally intransigent. But that said, he has governed as a Bill Clinton, basically, president. It's like the second Bill Clinton presidency has been the Obama presidency. And I think that the reason that tens of thousands, 15s of thousands people showed up for Obama early on was because we believed that he was going to do the kind of things that Bernie Sanders is talking about doing. Bernie has been talking about doing these things since the 70s. And he has been absolutely consistent in his perspective and his point of view, and he's not going to pull a bait and switch. And not to say that Clinton and Obama did a bait and switch, but a lot of us feel burned by those experiences. And
I do, absolutely. I voted for Obama, and I feel like he didn't do a bad job, but he didn't do what he promised. He really didn't.
Yeah. And I think that is what is, you know, bringing so much energy to the Bernie campaign is the fact that, you know, it's basically the same people who are all excited about President Obama. And Hillary Clinton was hoping to pick those people up because she was his Secretary of State and she's been very helpful with him. And I think that it may be dawning on the Clinton campaign, or maybe not, that people are looking at the Obama presidency and saying, you know, this was not the hope and change that we thought that, you know, that we danced our hearts out to make this guy the president for. I mean, in some ways it was. It was a revolutionary thing to have the first black president. He's done, you know, a lot of good. But he hasn't accomplished the things that the country really needs to get done. And in fact, by pushing TPP, he's actually, in my opinion, moving us backwards. I mean, this is scary stuff.
Absolutely.
So you know, it's which is not to dump on President Obama. He's in net been a good president, I think, and a hell of a lot better than, God, can you imagine if John McCain and Sarah Palin had become president and vice president? Where this country would be? I mean, it's just. Truly.
We would be in an all-out war in the Middle East, that's for sure.
Oh, not just the Middle East. We'd probably be at war in Southeast Asia, too. John McCain would try to reignite Vietnam. And probably in South America. We'd be down there, you know, trying to overthrow the Chilean government and certainly the Venezuelan government. And
Hillary is trying to steal some of Bernie's thunder, though. I saw her last speech there over in Iowa, and she started trying to hit on some of these things that Bernie's been saying.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
But will she actually do it? That's the thing.
The question. That's the question.
She says it, but she has never said it before.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton actually has a very progressive voting record, far more progressive than her husband's governing record. She was the ninth most liberal member of the United States Senate. I don't agree with all of her votes, but, you know, I believe she'll make a good president. I believe that Bernie Sanders will make a great president. And, you know, that's not an inconsequential difference. Derek, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Summer, back with your calls. And in about 5 minutes, we'll have Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service right here. And welcome back. Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Raton, New Mexico. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Tom, I'm sitting here looking at a quote by George Santayana. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Yep.
I think that's a perfect quote for these free trade agreements. And they are not even the past. They are the present.
Yep.
And with the fast pace of the world today, you better learn fast.
Yeah.
And Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, when it comes to the trade agreements, they do seem to have learned fast. While the other ones aren't stuck in the mud, the other ones are just thinking about their profit.
Well, they're thinking about their donor base. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump's a billionaire, and he doesn't care what the corporations think about him. And Bernie Sanders is not even a millionaire, and you know, and he doesn't care what the corporations think of him. You know, he worst comes to worst, he goes back to being a senator, and he's just telling the truth. He's just telling the truth. These guys, both of them. And so anyway, Jim, thank you for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim. Thanks for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I couldn't be more in agreement with your with our just implosion of manufacturing. And
yeah.
It just, as it disappears, and I'm so incredibly frustrated hearing politicians on both sides placate us and say, oh, we're going to give you incentives to have corporations. That's hooey. It's baloney.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they continue to ship job after job after job. That's our tax base.
Yep.
Here's an idea. Look, I worked for Obama, okay, here. I mean, and that's not an easy lift where I live in
West Virginia.
It's a blue dot. It's a blue dot in a red state, okay?
Right.
And my wife is a nationally recognized journalist. We're frustrated, man. We're angry because, I mean, I love Obama, and he has showed leadership, and I do agree that he has been confronted with unprecedented media barrage of negativity
and obstructionism by the Republicans. I mean, that in my opinion constitutes a criminal conspiracy. You look at what they did the night that he was inaugurated in 2009, on January 20th, 2009, at the Caucus Room restaurant here. That conspiracy where they got together and they said, we're going to block everything he does, and they
exactly.
They're blocking him from appointing federal judges.
Right. Federal judges, and you just had one of the I'm not sure where he's from, and I'm pretty sure it's the southern state, who represented, who retired, actually came out and admitted that their leadership told them anything he's for, we're against.
Right, even if it's something we were for before. Yeah,
it cannot possibly. I don't know if the American people comprehend just
they don't.
How ugly that is.
They don't. They not only don't understand. See, the media has never reported this. This is all insider stuff, and the media just kind of keeps this stuff buried underneath the radar screen. You know, they really don't want to make the Republicans look bad. If the real Republican agenda, this is why Bernie has said, okay, in the Democratic debates, we should welcome the Republicans to come in because we will eat their lunch. You know, because the Republican debates are not going to actually reveal the true Republican agenda. Mike, thank you for the call. I'm Harvin with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org for the news of the day, and the author of Sideswiped, Bob Ney is with us. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, now, you know, the caller was just talking about how some important things were kept down low, and there's a story I wanted to give, because there's a lot we can talk about today, Greece, Iran, et cetera. But one of the stories I wanted to bring out to the forefront, which is a down-low story, as I call it, is the debt ceiling freeze, and that's at $18 trillion. And with the temporary bill that the Congress passed, it kicked in around March the 16th, where there has to be freezes. So it's been about a 90-some-day period of continuing freezes. And what that affects is investments into the retirement system and United States investments. And this story, Tom, is really not being talked about, so they're up against the ceiling again. Now, when Bush was president, and I can go back because I was there at the time, I think, if I'm correct, there were six different votes to raise the debt ceiling without a whimper.
I believe that's sort the of, correct okay, number, yeah.
You vote, you go to dinner, it's all done with, maybe yep. a couple of speeches. Now it's turned into a major production. But this is just sitting there, and as we talk about economies and China and the 3 weeks worth of their crash, et cetera, and Greece, of course, which is important. But here within our own country, I just wanted to point out that this story was recirculating today. Of course, the story that was put out was to blame President Obama, you know, for the debt ceiling being at $18 trillion.
So you say that we're going to hit the debt ceiling in March of next year. Is that right?
Well, no, actually, under the temporary bill they passed, the Treasury Secretary had to take certain measures, so it just continues to be frozen. It goes down a little bit, it goes up, it gets within maybe 25 million of the debt ceiling, but once it hits 18 some trillion, it freezes. Mm-hmm. And then the Treasury has to take all these steps, which they've done in the past, because this has been the only time it's a controversy has been under the time when President Obama was elected.
Right.
So again, it's sitting there, plus we're around the corner of an August recess. And October the 1st starts the new budgeting period, and also the lack of a transportation initiative, which has been kicked down the road as a temporary measure. So I just want to point out there's a lot of temporary issues that are big deals that are sitting out there that aren't being focused at all.
So the Republicans have used the debt ceiling before to basically shut down the government or threaten to. When will that particular stuff be hitting the fan?
Well, it will be – actually, the Treasury is going to get to a point where they're just not going to be able to function to do this anymore. So somewhere around September, the Congress, one way or another, is going to have to deal, you know, with what's going on and also prepare for the October 1st deadline of the budget process.
Uh-huh.
And so pretty soon – now, the transportation bill, you know, states cannot plan. This is all temporary. That was kicked down the road, too, on a temporary basis. So – There's lack of planning, lack of the ability to invest in infrastructure. I don't know if these are going to become election issues, but they are surely big picture issues that, frankly, never used to be big picture issues.
Well, this is purely political. I mean, this is
course it is. Yeah. And in Hillary Clinton's statements, you know, she hit effectively on the fact that the Benghazi committee, you know, has not found a silver bullet. It has been a conspiracy to do all that can be done to, you know, affect the election. The downside, and in our notes in Talk Radio News, too, Victoria had indicated, too, but the downside, it was just sort of a 19-minute interview people were looking forward to, but it kind of was a little bit on the ho-hum side when you compare the fact of this week, Bernie Sanders, with a tremendous amount of crowds that showed up and some of the issues he's brought to the forefront. On the Republican side, if you think of Chris Christie, if you think of Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, any of the people in the race so far, their whole talk this week, Tom, was about what Donald Trump says or doesn't say.
Right, about immigrants. But what's interesting is I'm looking at the TV screen here, and I see a chyron that says, Trump, : I will bring jobs back from China, Japan, and Mexico. And that, I think, is why 10% of the Republican base is, certainly the racists are supporting him as well. But I think that, you know, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are the only two people talking about our crazy trade policies.
Oh, absolutely. Look, you had Pat Buchanan years ago, who was really a hero when it came to trade issues.
I had him on this program many times. We agree on these issues.
Yes. And there were coalitions where you had Bernie Sanders. I could go down a whole list of names of and a hardcore group of 50 Republicans that used to band together to try to kill these horrible trade deals.
Right.
Now, I don't think the Republicans also get it in the Congress. The fact that if you look at the polling, in a lot of cases, Republican constituencies rise even higher than the level of some within the Democratic constituencies they polled as despising, literally loathing these trade bills.
Right.
And so the only two talking about, you're correct, are Donald Trump, and that's why I think he resonates right now amongst a lot of people. And, of course, Bernie Sanders has made a career of trying to...
Oh, he opposed NAFTA in 92.
Right, right. And there was a standard, I just want to share an inside thing, but there was always a standard joke in the Congress. If you saw Bernie coming down the hallway, you better run, because during a trade bill or anything important to him, he would corral you. Of course, you know, we all worked on the same side as Bernie did, but he would corral you, and he would make you look at statistics and talk about the real impact, you know,
wow,
on working people.
Yeah.
Good about it.
Yeah, as a member of the House of Representatives, he was one of the people who got the most amendments passed, I believe, during his career. I saw the statistic the other day.
Financial Services Committee, he would constantly raise issues about the IMF. He would raise issues about the Import-Export Bank and about, you know, fairness in the system. So I just think that that is resonating across a wide spectrum of people, and I think he's got a lot of people looking at him, right, although the mainstream media has done the best they can to, you know, obviously ignore him.
Right. How's the Iran deal coming?
Well, the Iran deal is interesting because the Obama administration, I think, is using a bit of psychology and saying, okay, fine, look, we wanted a deal by the 9th. That was a self-imposed deadline, which would be, you know, tomorrow night.
Right.
But they said, okay, if we have to extend it, that's all right. So I think the Iran deal is still alive. They're not just holding to deadlines, and they're not as worried about the Senate as they were at the time.
Very, very interesting. Okay, Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe, reporter with the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, thank you. Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The president could clean up money in politics right now in advance of what may well be the most consequential election in the history of the United States, or at least in my lifetime, and probably your lifetime, because I'm probably older than you are. It's by simply issuing an executive order saying that if you're a federal contractor, in other words, if you get money from the federal government on a contract, and by the way, this isn't just like, you know, Koch Industries kind of thing. This is, I mean, I was a federal contractor once. I mean, back when we owned the ad agency in Atlanta, the ad agency itself was hired by, we were hired by the CIA, we were hired by the NSA, we were hired by Naval Intelligence, we were, you know. And we also offered seminars that were attended by virtually every government agency that there is, in addition to most of the Fortune 500 companies, on, you know, on marketing and communications. But then after I sold the ad agency, I also did a couple of day job, as a government contractor. I mean, you know, I got a call from one of these agencies. It was actually the NSA, and they said, you know, can you want to come down here for a couple of days, and here's what we'll pay you, and we'd like you to teach us about something. And I can't go into it all, but it was something that I thought was a good thing, and I did it. And so I was a federal contractor that year, and so the president could issue an order saying, you know, people like Hartman who are taking money from the government under federal contracts, at least this year, now that was in 2000, must have been, it was 1998, I think. But in any case, anybody who gets a federal contract has to disclose if they make any political contributions. And, you know, for up to 2 years, they can't bid on federal contracts if they spend a lot of money buying politicians or trying to influence elections because, you know, that might be things to their benefit. The president could do that. Number two, the Securities and Exchange Commission. They could make a rule requiring publicly traded companies to disclose all expenditures of money for political purposes and to get the shareholders. This, by the way, from this piece written by David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University in Minnesota and a member of the Scholars Strategy Network, published over at TPM. The SEC could make a rule requiring publicly traded companies, this is Mary Jo White, to disclose all expenditures of money for political purposes. Number three, the FCC, that's Tom Wheeler, the guy who just affirmed net neutrality, which the Republicans are doing everything they can to take down. The guy who runs the FCC, he could order all broadcasters to give free time to members of to serious, you know, legitimate candidates running for the House, the Senate, or the White House. And the IRS could say, you know, Karl Rove, or for that matter, you know, Martin O'Malley, your super PAC, sorry, it's not nonprofit anymore. I don't think we're going to see it happen, but it would be a marvelous thing if it did. Okay, some of the other things that I wanted to share with you today. I don't know if you caught this. This is a quote from the Pope's encyclical. And with a tip of the hat to Troy Miller, who sent this to me, he's filling in for Shano today as associate producer. It's over at thepeoplesvoice.org. For human beings, this is the Pope, a couple weeks ago, and this is the official now doctrine of the Catholic Church. For human beings to destroy the biological diversity of God's creation, for human beings to degrade the integrity of the earth by causing changes in its climate, by stripping the earth of its natural forests or destroying its wetlands, for human beings to contaminate the earth's waters, its land, its air, and its life, these are sins. Now, I doubt the Koch brothers are Catholic. I don't really know. But so, you know, if they're not Catholic, maybe they're not worried about burning in hell forever for pumping all those gases into the air. But, you know, the EPA has come out, well, as this article by Ophelia and Dylan Murphy at thepeoplesvoice.org says, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which, by the way, there is a campaign funded in part by the Koch brothers and there are some of their front groups, to either neuter or even put out of business the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA in the United States recently issued some pretty dire warnings that existing greenhouse gas emissions are going to cause major climate change with considerable consequences for the planet. You know, the largest organization in the world that is taking climate change really seriously and investing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, in getting ready for climate change? You know what that organization is? The U.S. Department of Defense. They know what's going on. They know that these scientists aren't just making this stuff up. They know that Jim Inhofe is a liar and a shill for the fossil fuel industry and a blowhard. And not just Jim Inhofe, virtually every Republican. Because they're all desperate for campaign cash from the fossil fuel industry. But the Pope now says, this is a sin. What you guys are doing isn't just bad, it's sinful. Cool. Bernie Sanders just introduced legislation. PoliticusUSA.com writes, Senator Bernie Sanders hit the Koch brothers where it counts by proposing new legislation that makes solar energy more accessible for low-income families. This is a verbatim quote from the statement that Senator Sanders' office issued. They have proposed this legislation. It's called the Low-Income Solar Act of 2015. Bernie dropped this on the floor, I believe, this week. Introduced into the Senate, he said, while the cost of solar panels has gone down in recent years, they're still out of reach for millions of low-income families who need it most. Families across this country struggle to pay electricity bills, and access to solar energy can help reduce these costs. The Low-Income Solar Act of 2015 was introduced on the same day the White House proposed an initiative to make solar power more accessible to households and businesses. The Sanders bill would provide $200 million in loans and grants to the Department of Energy to offset the upfront costs for solar arrays on community facilities, public housing, and low-income family homes. These projects would be required to prioritize loans for women and minority-owned small businesses and to set aside funding for developing solar arrays in Appalachia, Indian tribal lands, and Alaskan Native communities. A couple of other things. This kind of in the science news area that I wanted to share with you. Apropos of nothing in particular, University of Copenhagen and Herlev and Gentofte Hospital have collected data on 100,000 Danes examining their intake of fruit and vegetables. They discovered that high vitamin C concentrations in the blood, which you get from eating fresh fruits and vegetables, high vitamin C concentrations in the blood were associated with a 15% reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease, of course, is what leads to strokes and heart attacks, and a 20% reduction in the risk of early death. And here's another one. New findings published in the journal Cell Death and Disease reveal that a regular aspirin regimen, this is taking a baby aspirin every day, or taking a baby aspirin three times a week, for people who, you know, their stomachs get upset by it, could help slow the growth of mesothelioma, this is what killed my father, by blocking the effects of the inflammatory molecule high mobility growth box 1, HMGB1, which is believed to directly promote the growth of that disease. This molecule that is inhibited by, or enzyme or whatever it is, that's inhibited by aspirin also is associated with a whole variety of other conditions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, the inflammatory response seems to be at the base of most cancers and a whole lot of autoimmune conditions, arthritis, all kinds of things. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Justin in Scott City, Missouri. Hey, Justin, what's up? Justin, watching Free Speech TV on line 7. Okay, let's try. Justin, call us back. If you can hear me, I can't hear you. John in Highbridge, New Jersey. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I don't know if you remember back. The day after the Barack Obama was reelected, I called into your show. This is just a little self-indulgence on my part. You had Bernie on. And I said to him, now that we've managed to get the president reelected, is it too soon to start the grassroots campaign for the Sanders-Warren ticket?
Right.
And he kind of laughed about it and said he was looking forward to working with Elizabeth in the Senate and, you know, whatever.
Right. Right.
But now this is panning out to come true. And I believe that if he adds Elizabeth Warren to that ticket, you referred to her as the rock star the other day.
She is.
Listening.
Yeah.
And that becomes... That ticket now becomes one that the mainstream media people can't ignore.
You're right.
Where they have to pick it up. It's too big a story that they have to own it. Another thing, just a quick point, when you were talking about the trade policies with, you know, that Bernie talks about trade policies and Donald Trump, you know, the only two candidates that really talk about them. Bernie Sanders talks about a trade policy, and you understand a man who is thoughtful and considerate and is providing a solution. You know, he talks to you and you understand why the policies are failed and how they need to be changed. When Donald Trump talks about these policies, that racist dog whistle is piercing so loudly that you can't hear anything besides vitriol.
Yeah.
You know,
in a way, he's almost saying, you know, how dare those Chinese and Mexicans take our jobs away from us, you know, in a kind of a racist context. I don't disagree that there's a huge racist subtext to it, but I still think that he's reaching out beyond the racist base of the Republican Party to the anti so-called free trade base of the Republican Party.
Yeah, he touches on this. He touches on it in a Chris Christie-esque manner.
Yeah. Yeah, except that Chris Christie isn't saying that. Chris Christie is a free trader along with all the other ones.
Yeah, I was just talking about his thuggish approach.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah.
You know,
Donald loves. Yeah, Donald Trump, it, you know, I get, you know, the more I watch him, the more I'm thinking this is a kid who was born into a millionaire family in what would today probably be a billionaire family in today's dollars, inherited hundreds of millions of dollars worth of real estate from his father, blew it, at least some of it, and then built it back up. And, you know, I guess he deserves some credit for that, although he used the bankruptcy laws to do that. And we have specifically said that our young people cannot use the bankruptcy laws to do what Donald Trump did with regard to their college debt. You know, so Trump,
yeah, that's criminal.
Trump, yeah, it's so wrong. And Trump brags about, well, yeah, of course I've declared bankruptcy. That's what the laws are there for. You know, Henry Ford declared bankruptcy seven times. I did the same thing. I declared bankruptcy in order to make a buck. Well,
good. We'll elect Bernie, and the students won't have to declare bankruptcy because we'll provide a public education for everyone.
I agree. I agree. And I think it's time for a jubilee as well. John, thanks a lot for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Looks like the New York Stock Exchange got itself back together again, and United Airlines got itself back together again. And the big headline over at the Drudge Report is the stock of cybersecurity companies is rising. So it's like, you know, I started out the show saying if I was going to write a fiction novel, and, you know, by way of saying we have absolutely no evidence that there is anything that links these things together or that they were anything more than just a screw-up. An accident, a bad software patch, a cable that got cut someplace by a construction worker. Who knows? I'm sure we'll find out eventually. But if I was writing a thriller about a cyber war, the way I would, you know, if I was running China and I wanted to intimidate the United States, I would take down the largest airline in the country, cyber-wise, and then I would take down the stock exchange, cyber-wise. I mean, keep in mind, what was the target that bin Laden went after? The World Trade Center. And he made it very clear that that was, you know, there was symbolism in that. That America was, you know, economically colonizing the world, including his country, Saudi Arabia. So, you know, I would do those things, and then I would say, I would send a private back channel message to the White House going, more to come, unless you do this or that. You better get that Trans-Pacific Partnership signed. Actually, I don't think that's it. I don't think that's it. But, you know, Who knows? But let's not panic here. It's just, you know, the things, the real thing though to watch, and you know, we talk about a lot of things today. We've talked about a lot of things in this program. There's a lot of things in the news. The thing that I think represents a serious and genuine threat to the economic stability and thus the political stability of the United States is the collapse of the Chinese economy. Their stock market is down 30%. If it goes down to 50%, China's economy is going to fall apart. China's economy falls apart, we're next. And then we're in the crash of 2016. And by the way, this is one of the scenarios that I laid out in the book. And historically, if you look back on history, whether it was the great crash of 1700, which led to the British in 1773 enacting the Tea Act that lowered the tax on tea for the British East India Company so they could sell more tea because there was a worldwide depression going on. Whether it was the great crash of 1770, whether it was the crash of 1856, which led to the Civil War, among other things. I mean, that was also the year of Dred Scott. whether it was the Great Crash of 1929, which led arguably, in fact, I would say directly, to, you know, the crash in Europe, the rise of Hitler. There were other things that influenced the rise of Hitler. The biggest one, the Treaty of Versailles and World War One. But that's, you know, a whole complex thing. But anyhow, the Great Crash of 29, followed by World War II. That typically, when there is a worldwide economic crisis, it is followed by world war or serious war. I mean, the crash of 1700 mostly hit the United States and England. And who went to war? The United States and England. And then the dominoes started falling, you know, and then the French Revolution and so on. So this is something to keep a very careful eye on, and I think it's not being taken seriously enough by the mainstream media. It is being taken very seriously by the corporate media, by the financial media, by the business media. The Financial Times and presumably I don't watch them, but, you know, I would guess that the networks that deal with finance are taking this seriously. Justin, in Scott City, Missouri. Hey, Justin, what's on your mind?
Hi. Can you hear me? Are you here?
I can, yes. I am, and you are.
Okay. Yes, since I was a kid, I've been watching politics. I've been listening to politics. My parents, my grandparents, you know, presidents, I've been seeing them, you know, they come up with good ideas, get good issues, but nothing ever gets passed. You know, people in Congress, they're not about the American people. So my question is here, does it really matter who runs the presidency, who gets elected?
Yes.
If one person is ever going to get anything done for the American people with all the corruption and big corporate businesses overpowering politicians. You know, the issues with climate change, the American dollar declining, it's not a matter of it's a matter of time being wiped out. You know, they got us into these problems. How are we going to expect them to get us out?
Yeah, yes. The answer is yes. Presidents do get things done. Presidential elections are consequential. We had a brief progressive era in the United States from basically 1901 until the end of World War II. And then in 1920, and the top tax rate went up to 91% on the very, very wealthy. The big aggregated companies were broken up by Teddy Roosevelt and Taft, who followed him. Two Republicans, but they were progressives. And then the president in 1920, Warren Harding, ran on the election ticket of less government in business, more business in government. In other words, privatize and deregulate. And he came into office, and the first thing he did was drop the top tax rate down to 25%. He started deregulating industry like crazy, and it set off a bubble, which popped in 1929 and took down the United States. So, and then look at what FDR did. And I'll play some clips from FDR when we come back from the break, Justin. And I want you to listen to them very carefully, because this was an actual president of the United States who actually transformed this country. And then look at what Reagan did. Reagan completely reversed everything that FDR did. He actually transformed this country, and he brought us all this student debt. He brought us all this economic disaster, the destruction of labor unions. So, yes, presidential elections are consequential.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
They are very consequential. The president may not be able to do everything. We've certainly seen that with the Obama administration. But the president has the bully pulpit. They can raise hell, and they can make things happen. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And I promised you a little bit of FDR here, just by way of saying, you know, what can a president say and do that can actually change the course of American history? In 1936, Franklin Roosevelt had passed a minimum wage. The Supreme Court knocked it down. He had passed labor protections and the right to unionize. The Supreme Court knocked it down. There was a whole series of very progressive changes that the Supreme Court kept knocking down. FDR ran for re-election in 1936 and raised absolute hell about this stuff. Absolute hell. And in 1937, when he was re-elected and his second term in office began in January 37, the Supreme Court changed their tune. Because they got it that the American people were behind FDR. That's the power of the presidency. And here's what FDR had to say in 1936. I believe that this is from a speech he gave in Madison Square Garden when he was running for, when he was accepting the nomination of his party for re-election for his second term. And he starts out talking about how, you know, early on in this country, we didn't have billionaires and we didn't have, you know, the modern industrial behemoths, but they came along with the Industrial Revolution. Here's the first clip.
That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power. In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown.
And then he continues.
Struggle. But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free. For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things. Through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service.
All right, he's talking about the rise of the oligarchs. He continues.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
Who's he sound like? Yeah, who's he sound like? Okay, they continue. Next clip.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business. They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
And I would say today it's even worse than that, because back then corporations were not political. And now, and billionaires are not political, and now you've got Koch brothers-funded groups like ALEC that are sponsoring legislation to make it harder for citizens to vote. Right. Back then, at least the corporations and the billionaires said, well, yeah, sure, you can vote. You can have a government. Just don't mess with our business. FDR says we're going to do something about that. Here he is again.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. Man, it's like sitting in a Bernie rally. Yeah, here's the next clip. And this is where he wraps it up.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. but in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
There you go. That's it, right? That's the group of them. Okay, that's from, he was running. That was when he was running for re-election. On that platform, this guy was re-elected president of the United States 4 times. The Republicans were so horrified by that that they passed a constitutional amendment saying that no president could be elected more than twice. I mean, that's how successful that kind of rhetoric was in getting a guy elected president of the United States and transforming America. And Franklin Roosevelt transformed America. Ken in Powell, Ohio. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind? Ken? Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. You mentioned today about the New York Stock Exchange, United Airlines. By the way, New York Stock Exchange is not fully up at this moment.
Oh, really?
But here's, and I have no doubt that you are correct that the stocks and products of the cybersecurity firms, firewalls, software, et cetera, is going to fly.
Yeah.
CEOs are going to spend millions on this equipment and software. But here's the thing. They spend millions for this false security of firewalls, software, et cetera, that provide all the locks, the top-rated locks. But they hand the keys over to offshore companies in India and H-1B workers here.
Right.
So people paid $15K. They have the best locks in the world, but they hand the keys out to companies that are unaccountable, workers that are unaccountable.
Yeah.
How much would it take in bitcoins to buy the password and access to these systems from some Indian worker, some slumdog in India?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
And by the way, in the Philippines, it was only a year or two ago that they made it a crime for people answering the phone and taking your credit card information to write down that information and take it home and give it to their friends.
These same CEOs that are going to spend this money on cybersecurity are still going to look at their spreadsheets and go with the H-1Bs like we had just recently, the clumsiness of Southern California Edison and Disney, who aren't the first, aren't the last.
Right.
They just happen to get caught.
Right, yeah, Disney tried to lay off 300 people and replace them with foreign workers.
Here in Southern California, and then they had to train their H-1B replacements
right.
for 3 months to get their severance package. It's gotten to the point where the great article in L.A. Times says the jobs, as you know, you've discussed several times, you hired an H-1B. It was supposed to be for an American. You could not find an American to do that job.
Correct.
It's turned on its ear now. The only ones that are retained are the ones where they cannot find a cheaper H-1B to do the job.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Everything else is being replaced. They bragged, the managers bragged to the Southern California Edison employees, told one of them that they could hire 4 H-1Bs for the price they were paying for him and laughed at him.
Yeah.
But this is a national security risk. Recently, Verizon, a couple of years ago, turned over management of our military networks to Argentina. Until someone in Verizon said this is not a good idea and moved it back.
Yeah, it's we've outsourced so much of our national security and everything else. No, I'm with you, Dave. This is horrendous. Thank you for the call, Jonathan in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to. I'm involved with Utah for Bernie Sanders. That's the grassroots movement. I've seen a lot of grassroots movements all over the country, and they're sprouting up because Bernie's saying, you need to form grassroots movements. You need to get the word out to the people.
Right.
But don't you think that Bernie's real intention for this, for the grassroots movement, is to find and elect new members to Congress, people that aren't Democrats and Republicans, new faces?
Yeah, the problem is that because we have first past the post winner take all elections, it causes a country to end up with two political parties. So unless we go with instant runoff voting or with proportional representation, that's what we're stuck with, which is why Bernie's running as a Democrat.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if he doesn't win the primary, he's going to step back and support whoever does. So and I think that that's a reasonable thing, given the circumstance. We're not going to change the Constitution tomorrow. And welcome back, Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, first of all, FDR's words are just eerily, eerily familiar with what's going on right now.
It's
incredible, really.
We're right back there.
Also, Tom, I want to ask you real quickly here. This is really kind of off the wall here, but I believe I learned through your show, like so much other information I've learned from you guys. Ronald Reagan, I believe, signed the advertising, which is we're the only free Western industrialized countries in the world, I believe, that allow drug advertising on TV.
Yeah, well, it's us in New Zealand.
Did Reagan sign that?
New Zealand does, too. I don't know if Reagan did it or not. I remember for years and years and years it was illegal for pharmaceutical companies to advertise prescription drugs directly to the public, and then that changed. I don't frankly remember when it changed.
Okay. The other question then is, we know the power of Big Pharma. When did this actual truth and side effects phenomenon, which has got to really tick them off big time, to say, I'm in content, take this, but by the way, you could have a stroke, heart attack, or whatever as a side effect. How long has that been going on?
I honestly don't know, Jim. These would be good questions to ask somebody like Wendell Potter, who really understands that business and that industry. But if your point is that, A, they shouldn't be allowed to advertise at all on television, I agree with that, and I think we should go back to that, just like we've banned tobacco advertising. By the way, the tobacco companies are suing a number of countries that have banned tobacco packaging, branded packaging and things. If we sign on to TPP, who knows? Maybe we'll have tobacco advertising back in the United States. I mean, it's bizarre stuff. Anyhow, thanks a lot.
Again, real quickly, thanks so much for all you and Free Speech TV do.
You're welcome, Jim.
The average guy out there, what's really going on out there.
Thanks again. Thanks for your kind words. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I got a little Disney story for you here as well. Back in the summer of 1984, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, we took a little trip. When we lived in Wisconsin, Madison, went out to Los Angeles, stayed with my aunt, and we went to Disneyland for the 4th of July. And let me tell you what I was making at the time. At the time, because things are slipping away from the middle class, it's getting further and further out of reach, I was a painter's helper in a union shop at the time, making $10.85 an hour.
What year was this?
1984.
Okay, so that would be probably about $20, $25 in today's pay, right?
Well,
might be a little more than that even. It might even be $30 an hour.
Well, here's where the real disconnect comes in. She gave us her AAA map of Southern California. She gave us her car. She said, just run out there and have a good time. So we did. And when to get into to Disneyland with a AAA discount, the cost to get in was $14.
Right.
And right now, it's about $99.
Yeah.
So if you do the math, the pay that I was getting would probably be somewhere around $75 an hour.
If expenses rose the same way labor income did. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You're just seeing more and more examples of this, and just simple pleasures like that are just so out of reach for the younger families nowadays.
And it's a disaster. It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy, and it's the direct consequence of this free trade mania and 35 years of Reaganism. Steve, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Bobby in Kaiser, Oregon. Hey, Bobby, you wanted to invoke Anything Goes Summer and talk about something other than politics?
Yes, sir. You were talking about the vitamin C and the baby aspirin, and it made me remember a show I heard on one of the science channels here on the satellite. Some researchers in Europe were crunching some numbers and had noticed that people that donated blood versus people that don't donate blood had a 30% lower rates of cancer and heart disease and strokes and stuff. So they wanted to find out why. So they did some research and they found out, you know, when you donate blood, your body wants to replenish that blood as fast as possible. Blood is manufactured in the bones. And so your body gets all the blood out of your bones into your system, but it also sends out all of the stem cells
that are
in your bones. And so you've got all these stem cells flowing around, and if they come across something that needs repair in your heart or your brain or something, and that's what they're doing. They concluded that that's why people that donate blood at least twice a year have 30% lower rates of cancer and heart disease.
Bobby, 25 years ago or thereabouts in the United States, there was a study that was sponsored by the American Red Cross. I think it was called the Stedman study, that came to a very similar result. They said 25% reduction in death from all causes other than accidents for men and non-menstruating women. Menstruating women, giving blood made no difference because they lose blood every month anyway. But non-menstruating women, women past menopause, and men, that's absolutely true for. And I read that study. I'm familiar with it. And for the last decade, at least twice a year, I give a pint of blood. And I encourage every man to do that. And it also reduces your iron load, so it takes a load off your liver. But yeah, that's great. Thank you very much for the call, Bobby.
You're welcome.
I'm totally with you. James in North Adams, Massachusetts. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. Are you there?
Sure, I am. Yeah.
All right. I basically called because I had an idea that could actually help Bernie in a very cheap way to spread the word, because granted, not everyone's going to be able to go to his rally or see his rallies because of commercial TV,
right,
or corporate TV. And that is, if someone took in all of his, any of his rallies, encoded them as a DVD image so anyone can download them, burn them to a DVD, to a blank DVD that's playable in a DVD player, and then give them out to friends, families, and neighbors.
I think they're out there on YouTube right now, James.
Yeah, but not everyone. Like, in my apartment building, I'm the only one with a computer.
So
not everyone's going to be able to see it, and even if those who do have a computer, they're not always going to have the
bandwidth or
the time to go and look this up.
Right. So you could rip the... I mean, there's software to rip things. I don't know if it's legal or not, but you can rip things off YouTube and burn them onto a DVD and pass them along to your friends.
Yeah, you can't with YouTube because of how YouTube is, but if Bernie owns the copyrights to his rallies, he could legally have it encoded.
He could distribute it that himself.
And distribute it himself.
That's a good one. That's a good one. You know, James, thanks for sharing that. Kevin in Verona, Missouri. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me?
I do.
Okay. Hey, we was with some friends over the weekend, 4th of July weekend. It seemed like we was surrounded, my wife and I, by a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
They had all the facts wrong. You know, the labor unions are just in the country, and the crash of 2008 was the Democrats' fault, you know, because they had Democrats in the House and the Senate and all. And we almost felt like we couldn't even argue with them. But also proud of my wife because she stood up with me and said, no, you got it all backwards. And we tried to straighten the facts out for them. But look where we've been going since Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is a king to the Republicans. They think he is the greatest thing since peanut butter.
Right.
And your message, love the messenger and hate the message, kept going through my head. And I didn't get mad. My wife didn't either. But we just calmly told our side, and I think we might have switched a few thoughts, you know.
That's great. Well, that's how you do it. I mean, you respect people, and you respect where they're coming from, and just say, you know, I think you're misinformed, or, you know, have you considered this, or here's a little piece of information that maybe you didn't know about. That's great, Ken. Good on you. Thank you very much for the call. Douglas in West Hamlin, West Virginia. Hey, Douglas, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Douglas.
I just kind of had a last couple of days thinking about things and seeing how they're going. And it seems to me that the 1%'s kind of woken up and seeing how the people are wising up to what's going on and the support of Bernie Sanders, and they've kind of figured it out. And I wonder if it's just not like another Powell document rally, you know?
Yeah. And, well, what you're seeing right now is the consequence of the Powell memo. This is what I reprinted much of that and talk about this in my book, The Crash of 2016. You know, Lewis Powell in 1971 laid this out, and then Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court about how corporations needed to take over our universities, our political system, our court system, our public discourse, our newspapers, our media, and they've done it. They've done it, and so we're pretty much at the same place we were in 1932. Now, our economy's not as bad, but I think it could get that way fairly quickly. So, you know, is it happening again? Yeah, I think it could be, and it's a big problem. Douglas, thanks a lot for the call. Shay in Agora Hills, California. Shay, we've got just a minute until the end of the show. What's up?
Hi. I wanted to bring up about who I feel or Bernie Sanders, a vice president, should be.
I think it should be Elizabeth Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Excuse me.
Yeah. I was thinking a
woman.
Young person, hopefully a woman.
Yeah, I'm with you, Shay. I'm with you. Absolutely. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Hope you enjoyed the FDR clips. We got some Bernie clips that are very similar. We'll play those again one of these days soon. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you to participate. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.